Welcome in to the Towel Boys. He is Mike Romala over at RunRebs.com. I'm Tyler Bischoff here at Mountain West Connection. Been a little bit. I guess the last one we did was the Emergency Chris Wood podcast, right?
Yeah, that was the last one before your unfortunate ailment that kept you away from podcasting for the past week.
Yeah, I got sick. I had an earache for a little bit, and then I got, like, really sick, like, flu-type symptoms or whatever. That wasn't fun, but, you know, whatever. Here we are. We're going to talk about Ben Carter today. Taylor Byrne, the Sun, wrote a story about him. He could be out for a while. He's out at least until September, which is getting really close to when the actual season starts. We'll also talk about the schedule, because the non-conference schedule, I'm assuming UNLV is going to release the non-conference schedule like any day now. Usually it's out by now. We're recording this. By the time this actually gets posted, they'll have probably already released the entire non-conference schedule. But we're going to talk about what we know, because I think a good chunk of what is known is the actual meat of the non-conference schedule, plus the conference schedule is out as well. Also, Jalen Poyser, Justin Jackson, two UNLV commits, represented Canada in FIBA's U19 World Championships. They both played pretty well over there. I've seen some of their games. I'm going to talk about that and how they performed. And then also attendance, because UNLV's attendance in basketball dropped. They were down to 31st in the NCAA in total attendance, not in capacity. They were much worse in capacity, but 31st in total attendance. But let's start with Ben Carter. So Taylor Byrne wrote a story about him. Out until September at the earliest. He hasn't, like, done anything basketball-related in about 5 months, like, since, I mean, Dave Rice told us, like, that they had shut him down towards the end of the season, and he hasn't done anything, really, since then. Back issues for him. They thought it was just going to be something that they could rest and he would be fine, but then they found more issues with it, and he's had to have surgery, and he hasn't been able to do anything for a long time and won't be able to do anything until September. And again, that's at the earliest. The first game is November 13th against Cal Poly. UNLV could start the season with only two actual post players.
And once you start throwing around back surgery and, you know, out for, you know, more than 6 months and having to come back right before the start of the season, does that worry you that they may have to play a little bit longer with only two big men? I mean, can we count on Ben Carter to play a big role this season?
I don't know that you can. I mean, he said.
Granted, we don't know. Like, we don't know the. You know, we're not looking at X-rays over here. But the fact that he hasn't played or done any basketball activities in 5 months, it kind of raises some red flags.
Yeah, and just he says in that story that he is the weakest he's been since he was in high school. Like, he's not physically strong at the moment, and from what we saw in practice and from what Dave Rice, you know, loved about him in practice this past year was he was basically an effort and a toughness and a willpower type guy that got a bunch of rebounds and, you know, out-hustled people. And I don't, like, you can't be like this rebounding force in college basketball if you're at your weakest since high school. So I think there's a big concern there because he can't do anything until September. So he's going to have, you know, 30 days, 40 days to get ready. And I don't know that he will be. I mean, he could come back. I guess he could beat their earliest expectations and come back sooner than that. But right now, I mean, just reading that story, it was like, oh, Ben Carter's not going to play right away, or he's not going to be an impact player on this team for the first, I don't know, month, first half of the season, because, like, he's not doing anything basketball-related at the moment.
And he was ticketed for, and he still may be, but he's ticketed for a pretty big role. I would consider him sort of the glue guy for the front court, where you could sort of count on him to understand the game and play some minutes at while, you know, Steven Zimmerman sort of got acclimated, or while Good Luck Okonobo got acclimated to a different kind of role. So I think kind of counting on Ben Carter to play that veteran presence where he can play both spots and just sort of give you solid minutes, but I don't know.
So the UNLV has one scholarship left. I think it's kind of assumed at this point that it's going to go to Justin Jackson, but you know, if you're Dave Rice and you know Ben Carter's out for a while, and you know there's no guarantee that he'll be ready to go for the start of the season, would you rather have, even if it's almost just a filler guy, but would you rather have a true post player than bringing Justin Jackson on, or do you think it's more valuable to just get the more talented guy in here right away?
I think it's probably more valuable just to get the talent on the team, regardless of the position, especially we're seeing size kind of de-emphasized a little bit across all levels. I think as long as you're set, as long as you get a good performance out of Okonobo, as long as you get good performance out of Zimmerman, that should be enough to keep you going, assuming the rest of your team is healthy. I think that should be enough. It's just the depth is kind of concerning if you're down to those two. We saw it last year when you get thin and then every injury is a catastrophe.
Is there a chance that somehow there is a catastrophe, or maybe just a mini catastrophe, in terms of post depth next year?
If
we get into it, how much do you blame Dave Rice for it, if there is?
Well, if you remember last year, Good Luck Okonobo was battling the plantar fasciitis for a portion of the season, and it, from my experience, just you know, following sports my whole life, that's kind of a problem that can tend to crop up. You know, it's not something that, you know, goes away forever. It's something that can go away and then might come back the next year or the year after. So, I mean, who knows if Good Luck Okonobo feels that pain in his foot again and he's got to sit out for a couple weeks again. All of a sudden, if that coincides with the time that Ben Carter may be sitting out, all of a sudden you're down to one guy that can play in the post. So, I mean, it's definitely a real threat. That's something that could actually happen. I don't know if I would blame Dave Rice for that roster construction, because again, it's, you can't really count on two guys, you can't really plan for two guys getting injured. Is it worth using your final roster spot on a less talented guy just because of positional need or a positional weakness? I'm not so sure. I think that maybe they go the other way with it. Say you're down to two post players, maybe they use it as an excuse to go small and play that fast style that they keep that they're preaching once again this off season. I mean, does that seem like a good excuse to sort of say, oh, you know, F it, we're just going to throw out all of our young athletic wing players and see how much havoc we can create with one big man?
Oh yeah, I absolutely, like they have to, they're going to have to play small now. Like if Ben Carter misses any time or Ben Carter's not 100% to start the season, you've only got two big men. You can't play Zimmerman and Okonobo 40 minutes each for, you know, four or five games to start the season or whatever. So they're going to have to play small, and they're going to have to play small for probably extended period of time, because when you have just two big guys, even if they can both play big minutes, there's a good chance one of them is going to get in foul trouble probably every game to some degree. So they're going to play small. They're going to have to play small, and they're going to have to do it for long portions. So I don't know who the best small four is going to be on this team. I think a lot of people kind of pencil in Dwayne Morgan. I don't think it's going to be Dwayne Morgan, but I think there's a lot of potential now for just, we have to play small. And to be honest, they're not far away from having to play like five guards or five wing players. I guess you wouldn't consider 6-7 guys guards necessarily, but they're not far away from having to play five wing guys.
And that's something that I think that in a perverse kind of way, that would be kind of exciting to watch.
Like no doubt about it.
That's interesting. It would have to come at the expense of a couple injuries in the front court, but like, I would be excited to see that.
It would be tremendous.
Because as thin as they may be in the front court, I think both of us are pretty high on the collection of talent and the different fits and the versatility that they have on the wings and in the backcourt. I think we devoted a podcast to, you know, talking about some of the different lineups they could throw out there and some pretty intriguing combinations that, you know, I would be excited to see.
Yeah, no, I mean, put Pat McCaw at the five. That's all you got to do, and you're good to go. They'll win the Mountain West title with Pat McCall as the five. All right, moving on to the schedule. The Mountain West schedule is out, but first looking at the non-conference part, they're going to start with Cal Poly on November 13th. John Rothstein reported that a little while ago. They have the Maui Invitational. That's over Thanksgiving week, and then December gets really tough. Maui could be tough. I mean, there's Kansas, there's Indiana. They could play some really tough teams while they're in Maui, and then they come back in December. It's like, I think it's almost unnecessarily tough what they've done. It's going to be Oregon at the MGM on December 4th, Wichita State. They go to Wichita State on December 9th. They go to UC Riverside on December 12th. They come back to the Thomas and Mack on December 16th for Arizona State. And then they go to Arizona on December 19th. So once December starts, from the 4th to the 19th, they're going to play that stretch. That's three NCAA tournament teams. That's three road games. I am, like, why would they do this to themselves?
I would guess just because they want to, they feel like it's not a young team anymore. It's not like an inexperienced team anymore. They've got a veteran core that's played a full season together. And I think that Dave Rice probably feels like they're ready for this kind of schedule. And I think we saw the last couple of Selection Sundays, strength of schedule is kind of important. We saw some teams getting left out last year that had good records, but not as good of a strength of schedule. So I feel like this has always been part of Dave Rice's plan. Like part of his long-term blueprint ever since he was hired was raising the profile of UNLV by playing a marquee schedule. That's something that they sell to recruits. That's something that they use to promote the brand. They want he wants UNLV to be a national program. So they, one of the ways to do that is you have to take these games. Sometimes you have to go on the road to play Arizona or Wichita State, but those are good marquee games that a lot of people are going to be watching. So sometimes you've got to do that. It's not like the schedule is not always going to lay out perfectly where you have the perfect amount of rest and you get to pick and choose your home games. Sometimes you got to go out and play these teams to establish yourself. And I think that they're willing to do that.
But why a road game against UC Riverside on December 12th, which is going to come 3 days after your trip to Wichita State and 4 days before a home game against Arizona State? That one, it just seems like that game at UC Riverside, it's the worst team in this bunch. It's a road game, and it just seems misplaced. Like, it just seems like that game should be after Christmas or something. It shouldn't be sandwiched between Wichita State and Arizona State.
Maybe they value a chance to get a road win. You know, it's like you said, it's right after Wichita State. It's before they host Arizona State. Maybe they want to get a road win. Maybe they want to get some sort of a tune-up. Maybe they've got do they have any players on the schedule from that area? None are coming to mind right away, but I there's a million different reasons they could have scheduled that game. I don't have a huge problem with it. If they've got a couple days in between, they'll have time for a practice. Yeah, it's back-to-back road games in a 3-day span, but I mean, they'll be able to come back to Las Vegas. They'll probably have a practice in between then on their home practice floor, and then they'll a short skip over to Riverside and they'll play that game. I don't think that's that tough of a task.
No, it's not crazy. It just seems unnecessarily tough to do to yours. Like, they're the ones creating this. It just seems like they shouldn't do this to themselves. But all right, those five games. Oh, how many are they winning?
I think if we give them Riverside, and hopefully if you're a UNLV fan, you probably want them to win that Arizona State game at home. There's two. If you get one of the other three, you've got to be happy. So 3-2, you're satisfied coming out of that stretch.
Yeah, I think that's the way to look at it. You should expect to win at Riverside. You should expect to win at home against Arizona State. And then, yeah, the other three are the ones that, okay, you hope. I don't really know how good Oregon is going to be. I know Arizona's going to take a step back, but they'll still be pretty good. Wichita State, I think, has they're basically all their main pieces back, they're still going to be really good. So that's, I won't say an automatic loss, but that seems like that's going to be a loss. I think they could get the Oregon game pretty easily, but
the
I don't
game
think
is,
4-1's out of the question. I don't think 4-1's crazy in that stretch.
Wichita State, I think, is you have to expect a that's maybe the toughest game on the entire schedule. Oregon, it's you know, they're playing technically in Las Vegas, but that, it's just weird. It's like it's not their home court, so it's going to be a little bit weird. It's the new arena, like it's that could get a little bit weird. Arizona, they matched up well with the past couple times they played them. 2 years ago, they played at Arizona. They went right down to the wire. Last year, went down to the wire at the Thomas and Mack, and they won that game. So I think Arizona is doable. Oregon, probably your best bet out of those, the three tough games.
I know Arizona loses a ton of people. I don't know exactly what Oregon loses or has back. I know they lose their leading scorer in Joe Young to the NBA, but I don't know what else they have back. So, you know, I'm sitting here saying it could be a brutal stretch, but Arizona State, Oregon, and Arizona could all, you know, not be that good. You could go into that stretch and not one of them could be ranked potentially, in which case it wouldn't be all that tough. Although it's still three road games in 10 days, and what is that, 16 total days between the start of that stretch against Oregon and the close at Arizona. And then you also have the Maui Invitational where Kansas, Indiana, St. John's, Wake Forest, Vanderbilt, Chaminade, UNLV, and I think I forgot one team, but those are the majority of the teams that will be in Maui. So you could get a really tough stretch there. I mean, you could get Kansas and Indiana and like St. John's, or if you lose a couple games or whatever, you could end up with Vanderbilt, Wake Forest, and Chaminade. So that could go either way for UNLV. I imagine they'll get at least one good team and one bad team, and then a third game to kind of swing that is whether it's a good strength schedule trip or not. Mountain West schedule is out, and you play almost everybody twice. UNLV will not go to San Jose State, and Utah State will not come to the Thomas and Mack. I'm really high on Utah State. They were a really efficient team in Mountain West play, and they return their, I think they return, it's their top six they return, and they, like they only lose two players, and it was their seventh and eighth player. I'm really high on them. I think UNLV, in terms of wins and losses, got a little bit of a break missing Utah State twice.
Yeah, but it's also a little bit unlucky that the one game is going to be at Utah State. I mean, if you're going to play them once, you'd probably rather play them at home.
Yeah, and that's the one place UNLV got blown out in last year in conference play. They only got blown out once in Mountain West play, and it was at Utah State.
Exactly, and I'm with you on Utah State. I think they're going to be pretty good. And then San Jose State not getting them on the road is kind of a tough break because that's like an easy road win that you can kind of
well see.
Rely
I
on.
Think that's a good break because of how bad they are RPI wise. I think that's a good thing.
You think it'd be worse to their strength of schedule than the value of that road win would be just for the team and their mentality and being able to go out and get a road win?
I absolutely think so because I mean we saw it last year. Every time somebody beat San Jose State in the Mountain West, their RPI dropped. Like even if you get a road win, when the RPI values road wins, your RPI dropped when you beat San Jose State because of how bad they were. And usually it drops significantly as well. Early in the season, it dropped significantly. Once the end of the season came, there wasn't quite as much movement. But if you avoid San Jose State twice, I think you won the conference scheduling. Like, I think that's the biggest thing you can do because they're going to be a 340 RPI team, 320 RPI team. Those are the teams that I've been saying, like, you can't schedule those in the non-conference. Well, there's one sitting there in your conference schedule twice. If you can get that to just once, I think you do really well. Like I think that's tremendous for UNLV is avoiding them for a second time.
That's a good point.
But overall, I didn't pay too much attention to the schedule being released because you play almost everybody twice.
Yeah, the Mountain West schedule is not as fun to dissect as the non-conference schedule, because I mean, you basically know what it is. It's just when are you playing them, and like where are you playing them? You know who you're going to play. It's just semantics of basically ironing out the exact details. It's not as interesting, but
I don't expect either of these teams to be good next year. But UNLV does have the at Colorado State, at Wyoming swing as their second and third game of the conference schedule. Now, again, Wyoming loses everything. Colorado State loses almost everything. So I am not expecting either team to be very good. Colorado State has a decent recruiting class, so they should put together a decent team. But I don't know. Like, I have no clue what Wyoming's going to do next year, because it's not like they just lose Larry Nance. They lose a lot. So I don't think they're going to be very good, but it is tough going to both of those. You do close with San Diego State again. You get the last four games are home against UNR, at Boise, home against Wyoming, and at San Diego State. So the games leading up to that road game at Viejas is not too challenging, because I guess Boise will be pretty good, but it's not. I don't look at it and see anything and say, "Oh, that's a brutal, brutal stretch."
No, it's nothing too tough. There's a couple points that Colorado State Wyoming swing that you mentioned. I think they go 14 days without a home game. So that's kind of, if you're a UNLV fan, you won't be seeing them for a while. But yeah, nothing looks too difficult. It's the San Jose State, which I come around to your thinking, you convinced me that's probably a good break that I miss them. Utah State, I'd rather have them at home, but what are you going to do? It's an unbalanced schedule. It's not going to be balanced. You know, you're going to have some not everybody's going to be even there, so you got kind of tough break there. But for the most part, it's nothing really to criticize or to nitpick, I don't think.
Yeah, I think the toughest stretch for UNLV, they go to Utah State, they go to UNR, then they come home for Boise and home for San Diego State, and then they go to New Mexico. If New Mexico is any good, and I'm not so sure they will be, but if they are, you have to go to New Mexico. That's five games there that, you know, Utah State I think is going to be really good. San Diego State's going to be good. Boise State will be okay. You got to go to UNR, go to Reno. That's not necessarily going to be an easy thing, even if they're a bad team, and then you have to go to New Mexico.
Nevada, Reno, even if they're bad, that's still like a rivalry game on their home floor. And then same thing with New Mexico. Like, even if they're not as good as they've been during this recent past few years, that's still a tough place to play. UNLV has had some trouble there. So like, even if those teams aren't great, those are still not easy games.
Okay, I'm going to go way too in-depth on Canadian teenagers now. Jalen Poyser, Justin Jackson, two UNLV commits, represented Canada in the FIBA U19 World Championships. They finished fifth overall in that tournament, so not a bad showing for Canada. First off, Canada's best player is Oregon's Dylan Brooks. So UNLV will see him at MGM. He was a freshman last year. He was actually the second top scorer out of all players in the tournament at 18.8 points per game. He was the major, in terms of shot taking, he was the guy that took the most shots for Canada, but it had spread it around actually pretty well. Starting with Justin Jackson, he was a starter for Canada. He played in six of their seven games. He left their first game with a leg injury. He fell down, got his leg kind of twisted, and the body fell on it, and he had to be helped off the floor limping. He sat out the next game, but that was against Tunisia, and Tunisia is terrible. So I think that was more just, hey, we don't need you, you just get ready, rather than he was actually injured, because he came back and played in every game. His averages were 29 minutes, 15 points. He shot 46% from two. He was 6 of 15 from three, which is 40%. Was only 45% on free throws. Got 8 rebounds as well. And then the way too in-depth part, Mike, is shot selection. Because FIBA is wonderful and puts shot charts on their website, I went in and discovered that Justin Jackson took 26% of his shots in the restricted area, 44% of his shots in the paint outside of the restricted area. So 70% of his shots came in the paint.
That's are you licking your lips
awesome. Yeah. That's tremendous. And then he took 19% from three and 11% from outside the paint, inside the arc. Yes, 70% of his shots in the paint. That does include 12-foot jump shots from in front of the free throw line, which he does take some of those. But ultimately, he takes pretty efficient shots. He didn't shoot a tremendous percentage, but he ultimately has some characteristics of a pretty efficient guy. I will say this. He looked a little lost defensively. He kind of lost his man frequently and would be a couple steps out of position. But other than that, he looked pretty good offensively. He did struggle with his left hand. I think that the very first game he played in, he missed like four layups with his left hand. And they were like kind of contested layups. But it was like he couldn't hit anything on that side at the rim. So I don't know if there's any concern about him finishing. But ultimately looked pretty impressive. Some of the competition's not great over there. But I think there's good things when you look at Justin Jackson.
Is he, well, I didn't get to see these games, but when you're watching these, do you think that he's a guy that, for what we know, he's still up in the air in terms of whether he's going to play a prep year, another prep year, or whether he's going to reclassify to 2015 and play for UNLV this upcoming season? So, like, is he a guy watching him? Did you think that he was ready to jump in and play enough minutes to contribute at the Division I level? Could he play for this UNLV team next year?
I don't think he would based on what's in front of him. So I think it would be best for him to, I mean, either come to UNLV in redshirt or just go ahead with that extra prep year. I do think if UNLV needed to, like if they didn't have the wing depth that they have, I think it'd be no problem. He could come in and play 12 minutes a game and be useful, because he was a guy that could catch the ball when somebody else drew a help defender and try to get to the rim or try to get a shot in the paint, which is, I mean, excellent if you can get a guy that can catch, you know, on the perimeter and try to get to the paint and put up a shot. Even if you don't make him at a high percentage in this tournament, you can hopefully develop into that. So I think he could help them, but I just think there's too much in front of him that it's wouldn't really be worth it, in a sense.
What do you think his position is? I mean, like,
He played three for Canada. Like, I think he played a little bit of four from what I saw, but he was primarily a wing player for Canada.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, I mean, he was the starting three for them, and Canada ran a lot of horn sets, and he would, for Dylan Brooks, and he would be on the wing and wait for a pass if his man helped off too much. But I think he's useful. I think he'll be good at UNLV once he does come here and has a year under his belt as a Rebel. But I think he'll be pretty good. Jalen Poyser didn't play as much, came off the bench. He played in seven games, averaged 14 minutes a game. There were three games where he just barely got in a little bit. He averaged 8 points. He shot 50% on twos. He was just 5 for 24 on threes, which is 21%. So shot a lot of threes, but didn't shoot them very well. His per 30 numbers would have been 17 points per game on 17 shots, 8 rebounds, and 3 turnovers. Now, his stat, the thing about Poyser and his stats, they're a little inflated because he played big minutes against Tunisia. And again, Tunisia is terrible at basketball, or at least their U19 team is terrible at basketball. He played 33 minutes against Tunisia, scored 22 points. Didn't shoot the ball very well, though, but he had a big game against the worst team that they played. His shot selection looks pretty good, too. 26% in the restricted area, 24% in the other part of the paint. So that's 50% in the paint for a, you know, somewhat shorter player. Only 6% of his shots were 2-point shots from outside the paint, and then 44% were 3-pointers.
That's another really good shot chart.
Yeah.
I think Canada's teaching it right.
Oh God! I gotta look up who their coach is because I am absolutely in love with what they do offensively. Like they run a lot of horn sets. I love horn sets, and they shoot threes and get to the rim. Like that's what they do. It was like this is what I would do if I was trying to tell a team how they should play. It was great. So I need to look up who their coach is. One thing with Poizer, he didn't state like guys could dribble right past him. Like even Tunisia. Tunisia scored like 30 points in the game against Kansas. It was like 90-30. Tunisia dribbled right past Jalen Poizer all the time. And then the other thing that I noticed he struggled with was finishing over defenders at the rim. But he's Poizer's really good in transition, and what he was good at in the half court was he'd stand on the perimeter. If his man just two steps out of position, he would catch and either put up a somewhat open three, or what he was good at was being able to get past his man and to the rim. Now, he didn't always finish over the help guy, but he could get past his man and get to the rim. So I think he's got a good skill set that can come in. Another thing, he did not play point guard, like, at all in the tournament. Like, he was only an off-the-ball player.
And he's a guy who's been saying all along that he seems like one of those guys that was adamant that he was a point guard and that he wanted to play point guard. But that's good to hear that I like the at the rim numbers and the fact that he's like dribbling and getting to the rim, because that's something that the UNLV really didn't have enough of last year. Cody Doolin was not really that type of player, and it seemed like as the year went on, like once they lost Vaughn, McCaw was really the only guy that could drive through a defense and get into the lane. So adding another guy who has the ability to do that, I think is a good thing.
How far overboard did I go with watching and giving you too many numbers on Canada U19 World Championship?
I think you're good. I wish that we had shot charts for every player in college. I wish we could do these kind of breakdowns all the time.
Absolutely.
You think you see anything in Poizer that makes you think that he is going to challenge Jerome Seegers for minutes? I think we both agree that Seegers is going to get the lion's share of minutes, and he's sort of entrenched. Do you see Poizer like pushing him at all or chipping away at those minutes?
I don't think he's going to be good enough defensively to actually take some away, but he likes to shoot threes. He didn't shoot very well in this tournament, but if he can shoot it, he might push Dave Rice to like, well, the kid's shooting 40%. I got to get him in there at some point. But just defensively, he doesn't look like he's going to be ready to come in and play big minutes. So I question that a little bit, but he offensively, I think, you know, he's got a touch up finishing at the rim and, you know, just overall putting the ball in the basket and not missing as much, but he's got the right mentality offensively that he could play on the offensive end next year or this year, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, and all the scouting reports I've seen on him are that, like you said, he's good in transition, and that's sort of a strength of his, like in the open court and, you know, being aggressive with the ball before the defense gets set, which I think fits into what UNLV says they want to do this year. So, I mean, if you're seeing that, I guess that's another positive, that if they really play that style, the more they play that style, the more opportunities there will be for him to get on the court, if sort of playing to his strengths.
Oh, yeah, and especially if they only have two big men the whole season. All right, now time for curling the stash, bullet points of the show, just a couple of them today. The first one, something that we haven't mentioned, it happened a while ago, Eli Carter, former Rutgers, former Florida transfer, did not pick UNLV. Probably best for all involved because he could potentially have been kind of the odd man out in terms of the rotation, and Dave Rice could have had a one-year transfer guy not playing, which would have looked, I don't know, bad for Dave Rice maybe.
I think everyone was just kind of confused by that visit.
By that whole interest.
The fact that they were sort of considering each other. Like, I don't think I saw one person either in the media or any like fans on Twitter or anyone saying like, oh, this is a good idea. He feels like a need for us, or I could see him playing a role next year. It's just everyone's kind of confused. You know, it's like another short guard. He's not a good shooter. Reports were that he was unhappy with his minutes. Like, nothing sort of seemed to be a good fit.
looking at the summer league, because both Rashad Vaughn and Christian Wood are going to be playing in the Vegas Summer League. Rashad for Milwaukee, and he might be the best player on his summer league team, because the Bucks roster does not look very strong. They have, like, the only other player that looks good is Johnny O'Brien, who was their second round pick last year, and I don't even think he played in a game for Milwaukee. So Rashad might be taking 30 shots a game in the summer league, but the Bucks play on the 10th at 3 o'clock, the 12th at 3:30, and the 13th at 1 o'clock. So a lot of early games for Rashad Vaughn. The Houston Rockets with Chris Wood, they're going to play on the 10th at 7, the 12th at 1:30, and the 13th at 7. So Chris and Rashad play on the same day. In those first four days, but at different times. So you could conceivably see both of them play all six games, and then they start the tournament portion of the summer league, and then who knows when they play. Chris Wood, he'll be playing at least with Sam Decker and Montrezl Harrell. Decker from Wisconsin, Harrell from Louisville, who the Rockets actually drafted. And then I've got a non-UNLV curling the stash, but it is Las Vegas. Las Vegas was the 10th most tuned in city in the United States for the USA Japan Women's World Cup final.
I watched it
on Sunday. I did too. I mean, I watched basically all of the tournament, but
I
was surprised that they had the 10th highest rating of any city for that game was in Las Vegas.
I gotta be honest, when I turned on the game or the match, it was 4-0. It was about 20 minutes into the match, it was 4-0. But I watched the entire rest of the thing. Like I sat down, I said to myself, I was like, oh man, I missed it. There's four goals in 20 minutes. Now there's not going to be any for the rest of the match. So like I missed all the action, but I'm going to watch this anyways. But there were a few more goals and like it, you know, there was some intrigue there and it was fun to watch. So as a point for soccer.
I love soccer for whatever people who listen. I do love soccer. So are you surprised that Las Vegas was the 10th most tuned in city?
I don't know how I would gauge like soccer fandom in Las Vegas. Like I know that some people were excited when there was a chance to get an MLS team here, but then it seemed like there was an equal amount of people who were like adamantly opposed to like an MLS team here. So, I don't know. I guess 10th is, I would be surprised by that. I would not have guessed that they were 10th in the entire country.
In terms of pro sports coming to Vegas, I think like the NFL would be the king or whatever. But I think the NBA would do well. I think MLS would do like the third best. And then, you know, whatever, the NHL, Major League Baseball are somewhere behind that. But I think the MLS would do well in Las Vegas. The only thing that would kind of keep it from doing well is that the season does span over the summer months, and that cannot be great. But, I mean, the 51s are surviving. So I feel like the MLS could do well in Las Vegas, but, of course, now they're going to have a team, I think, in Minnesota it is, and Atlanta are their next two expansion teams. So that's who beat out Vegas.
The thing that I would like about if an MLS team were to come to Las Vegas is that it would feel – more like a local team. Whereas if you get an NFL team or an NBA team, or as you're seeing with the hockey team, those are going to be on the strip. Those are going to be just as much for tourists as they are for the locals. Yeah. You know, that's more about the spectacle and all that stuff. But I feel if you get an MLS team, I know they wanted to put the stadium downtown, but like I could see it working like on a local, like you away from the strip, you can develop like an actual local fan base. And like, I could actually see it working in that regard in a different way than football or basketball would work here.
Yeah, no, I really do think soccer would work in this city, but moving on to attendance, the NCAA, they had released some attendance figures earlier, but I think they released the actual rankings for college basketball attendance. UNLV dropped down to 31st. This year at 11,757 for their average attendance. According to Sean Cunningham on Twitter, UNLV was 21st last season, and that number, 11,757, is the lowest attendance number since the 2006-2007 season. New Mexico and San Diego State were the only Mountain West teams with a better overall attendance number. But if you go by capacity, UNLV was 110th in capacity at 66%. San Diego State, New Mexico, and Utah State all had a better capacity percentage than UNLV. That's low. They were not good last year, not necessarily unexpected. But I will ask you this, because I was surprisingly, I know, a couple people tried to argue with me about Christian Wood and whether or not he deserved what he got or whatever. I don't remember exactly what their arguments were, but somebody at some point mentioned that about fan support and that fans were mad that they showed up and Chris Wood didn't. And my response was the fans didn't show up. Is it fair to question Chris Wood's effort, or is it fair to question any player's effort when the fan support is like the worst it's been in almost a decade?
I think though you can't really tie those in together. Like, if you're a player, you have an obligation. You should have like an inner drive to play no matter what the circuit. You could be playing in an empty arena on closed circuit TV, and you should still be playing as hard as you can. Like, that's one thing. I know that's not always realistic. It's tough to get that same verve when there's like no one in the stands. And we saw that at UNLV this year. Like, it doesn't really surprise you that the attendance was down so low. It doesn't come as a shock to me, just like thinking back and like during the season, how many times were you ever like impressed by the crowd that they had at Thomas and Mack, where you were like, oh wow, these guys are filling it up, or what, this place is really loud tonight. I think the Arizona game was really the only time when the crowd made a difference in any game during the season. And it is really the only time they made their presence felt during the entire season. And that was for like a big marquee non-conference game. For the most part, like the crowd is a non-factor. I don't think they had a lot of people there, and I don't think the people that came were very vocal or engaged in the game. So I think that I'm not surprised that the attendance numbers are coming in now and that they were so low.
I think it was the UNR game that was a close game basically the whole time, and UNLV ends up losing that game on the jump shot from the top of the key. But that crowd was dead the whole game. They didn't make any noise. And the Utah State game, when UNLV came back, and I don't remember what their run was in the last 2 minutes, but a ridiculous run to get that game into overtime, the crowd was dead until the last 2 minutes. I mean, they got excited when Pat McCaw hit the floater that was actually an alley-oop pass to send it into overtime. But I mean, they were absolutely dead in those games, and it was like that for basically the whole conference season. So, a lot of that has to do with being 18-15 and being under 500 in Mountain West play. And to me, I mean, here's how I view it: if you're a fan, you don't have any responsibility to show up. You don't have any responsibility to pay for things or to be loud. But I think there's a factor that UNLV fans, they want to be proud of their home court, and they want to be known as a tough place to play and as good fans that support their team and as loud fans. But you can't claim those things after last season.
No, not at all. Like, that the Thomas and Mack Center is, in terms of college basketball arenas, it's a big place. So it's like, it's hard to fill up. It's a lot bigger than most other venues. And because of that, you know, 10,000 people at Thomas and Mack can seem like a graveyard, whereas 10,000 people at, you know, some other school may be an overflow crowd, and it, you know, people are hanging from the rafters. So that's one issue, is that, you know, it's a big place and it's hard to fill up. But I don't think anyone, if you polled the rest of the teams in the Mountain West, I don't think anyone would name the Thomas and Mack Center as one of the hardest places to play. Like, it's just, the crowd is just not really a factor for their home games.
Yeah. All right. You're going to guess the top 10 teams in attendance in the NCAA. And I'm going to see how many you get right.
Dude, I have no idea. I won't get one.
It's not hard.
I won't get one.
It's not hard. Yeah, you will. It's not hard.
It's got to be places with, like, that play in big arenas, right?
I mean, like, yeah, it's the top 10 attendance.
Syracuse.
That's number one. Look at you.
Who else plays in a bit? North Carolina.
Yeah, they're number four.
Duke.
Duke is not on there. They play in
a small place. I'm trying to think of teams that play in domes or like multi-purpose arenas.
Just think of good teams.
Kansas.
Yes, Kansas was seven.
Kentucky.
Kentucky was 2.
That's it. That's all I got.
That's all. All right, here we go.
Those are the only good teams in my mind.
Here we go. Syracuse 1, Kentucky 2, Louisville 3, North Carolina 4, Wisconsin 5, Creighton was 6, Kansas was 7, Indiana 8, BYU was 9, and Nebraska was 10.
That's just in terms of total attendance.
Total attendance. Total butts in the seats for the whole year.
Hmm. Okay.
The state of Nebraska has 2 teams in the top 10. Like, I think they both... Creighton plays in a big arena in Omaha. And Nebraska, I think they just got a new arena. I think it was, like, their first year last year, and I think it's huge.
And Nebraska football has always had just, like, a gigantic... Rabid,
oh, yeah.
Like, they're, like, one of those 100,000-seat, like, stadiums, right? It's, like, a gigantic stadium.
But they suck at basketball.
Yeah.
Like, they're not any good, but there's nothing... Like, I've got family from Nebraska. There's nothing else to do in Nebraska.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, those Nebraska schools, you sort of have a built-in audience there, a captive audience, I would think.
But it's just like you'd think Nebraska was Kentucky or something with how having two... I mean, you've got Kentucky and Louisville in the top 10, and then you've got Creighton and Nebraska in the top 10. So I figured you wouldn't get though. I figured you'd get more than that, though. You got 4? I don't know. Figured you might get Louisville or Wisconsin or Indiana, but I guess not. All right. Overall, if you look at the Mountain West and their attendance, they were the 7th best conference in attendance, which seems to be pretty
that
good.
Seems about right.
They dropped a little bit. On average, they lost 300 people per game in Mountain West games. But the tournament was just the 10th most attended conference tournament last year. And if you compare it to the WCC, they had 400 per session more than the WCC last year. So that's not very many more than the Gonzaga and BYU tournament.
Which is also in Las Vegas, like right down the
yes,
street.
Yes, I was going to ask you, if the Pac-12 moves into MGM's new arena, and if the Mountain West coaches get their way and get the tournament out of the Thomas and Mack, like, is the Mountain West a shoe-in over the WCC to, like, be MGM's preferred conference tournament in their Garden Arena?
I don't know. It
was a bad year for the Mountain West, and they still had more than the WCC. Like, you can look at it that way, but, like, Gonzaga and BYU are the constants in that conference. At least Gonzaga is. And Gonzaga travels really well for that conference tournament. And they fill up the Orleans. And BYU travels pretty well as sort of a second fiddle type team. It seems as though Gonzaga is a constant. They're going to be good. They're always going to be good. So they're always going to have fans at their conference tournament. If you look at the Mountain West, who's that team right now? It's San Diego State. And they don't travel to Las Vegas unbelievably well like Gonzaga does. As far as my understanding in the past, it's been UNLV and New Mexico fans
in my experience, New Mexico seems to be the out-of-town base that travels the best to the Mountain West tournament.
So if you have the Mountain West tournament, and if UNLV and New Mexico are good, it'd be fair to say they're going to have a much better attendance than the WCC, and it's going to be much more popular. But can you look at that and say, hey, they're going to be good and we can bet on that? Or, you know, what if you have a year when Wyoming wins it and they have 7 fans there, or a year when Boise State wins the regular season and they have 7 fans there? Like, it just seems like you know what you're getting with the WCC. The Mountain West, it appears as though in terms of people coming to the tournament, could be a little bit more volatile.
Yeah, no, I agree. It seems like you're sort of gambling on which teams are going to be there for the longest, whereas the WCC sort of had a sure thing. Is the Pac-12 set for that with their tournament in Las Vegas?
No, not at all. No, not at all. It's just, I don't know if it's expected, but it's thought that when the MGM opens their new arena, that they'll have the Pac-12 go play in that during their conference tournaments. Like, it's not like a done deal, and I don't think it's like a, I wouldn't say it's an, ex, well, maybe it is expected, I don't know, but it appears as though in a couple years that the option for the Mountain West to leave the Thomas and Mack will be there, but it'll be to go to the MGM Garden Arena. So we'll see. All right. All right. Are you annoyed by anything, Mike? We're going to get to that if you are.
I'm not. You know what? I'll leave it for next week.
Okay.
The next podcast.
I'm not really annoyed by anything, but I do have one more thing that I do want to talk about. And I am becoming more and more convinced that Dwayne Morgan is going to transfer after this season because he's not going to play because he's an idiot. I just don't think he's going to be very good. So he tweeted during the NBA draft when Larry Nance got picked in the first round. He tweeted, "My mans gave Nance 20 straight in the first half." He also tweeted something else about Christian Wood and Larry Nance and their first meeting, but he deleted it. I don't remember exactly what it was. But it seems as though he forgot that Larry Nance and Chris Wood both finished that game with 29 points and that Wyoming actually won that game. Also, Chris Wood didn't exactly give Larry Nance 20. He gave Larry Shiat 20.
He gave an open section of the court 20 points.
Yeah. Like, Larry Shiat decided, hey, we're going to double-team Cody Doolin off these ball screens. And Dave Rice was like, okay, we're just going to keep running these ball screens over here. And Chris Wood just had 10 feet of space minimum to shoot or attack the basket. And that's why he started the game with the first 19 points for UNLV, which actually started the game for 19 points. So the last 31 minutes of the game, Nance held him to 10 points on like 4 of 9 shooting. So when Nance actually had to guard him, it kind of slowed him down. Didn't really have anything to do with Nance. The other thing Dwayne Morgan has tweeted this summer is, last thing I'm worried about is critics or any basketball analysis. And that would explain his shot selection.
You think that's in reference to, what is that? Had anything come out at the time that was talking about his?
No, not that I'm aware of. There wasn't anything I had seen or read or heard that was about Dwayne Morgan not being good at basketball or analyzing Dwayne Morgan. I know I'm probably the leader of the Dwayne Morgan's no good fan club, but or maybe just Dwayne Morgan hate clubs better. But no, I don't know. Like, he just kind of out of nowhere, and if you're gonna say I don't have time for basketball analysis after you were legitimately the only one on the team that took 2-point jump shots, I'm kind of going to question that and just assume you don't understand what's happening.
Well, I know some the UNLV the coaching staff has time for basketball analysis. I know that they track that kind of stuff. I know that they track, you know, the shot charts and the field goal percentages from different parts of the floor. And I know that they don't want him shooting long 2-point jumpers. I know that they didn't want him shooting long jumpers after the first intra-squad scrimmage last year when, you know, the shot selection first cropped up for Dwayne Morgan, and he was shooting a lot of those quick jumpers and not making any. So I know that Dave Rice, mentioned it then. He's, you know, he says, hey, we've got to correct his shot selection. We don't want him taking those kind of shots. And it worked a little bit, but there was no major shift in his style of play, and there was really no one else that they could put in there because of the depth of the team and how thin they were. But I think that's going to be a different story this year. I mean, they've got Derek Jones, they've got a bunch of different options that they could put in at his position. He may not be able to fire those shots with impunity anymore without worrying about playing time.
Tell me why this won't happen. Dwayne Morgan averages 2.3 minutes a game and transfers after this year.
Because he's so good on defense that he's going to earn playing time because of his defense. And the light is going to go on offensively where he understands, I need to not dribble in traffic. I need to not shoot jump shots. I need to catch the ball on the move and finish around the basket and get out in transition. And that's all my team needs from me. They need me to do that on offense. and guard three positions on defense and switch all the time and create turnovers there. And if I do that, I'll be a superstar in this system. And he gets it, and he has a great year.
And I have no faith in that happening.
Well, judging by the tweets, it doesn't sound like that's what he's focusing on. But maybe the first couple of times he gets benched for, you know, bad shot selection, it starts to come around. Hey, like, let me focus on the things I'm good at, and let me help the team that way.
Like, late in the season, there were some moves he made to get to the basket or to get to the paint that were really good. And it was like, oh, that's why Dwayne Morgan was, like, kind of expected to do stuff and why Dwayne Morgan was highly touted. But we just didn't see nearly enough of that. We saw way too much of, all right, 15-foot jumper, let it fly. I have no confidence that Dwayne Morgan is going to be a useful piece of this team. I really don't.
If he could move his jumpers into 15 feet, I think that would be a good sign. Like, it was like 18, 19 feet. You know, he's like at the top of the arc almost. Yeah. I think 15 feet would be, we could chalk it up as an improvement. But, yeah, I mean, playing time is going to be hard to come by. It's competition. The guys that coaches, it's a favorite, like, talking point for coaches in every sport. It's like, you have to, if you can create that internal competition, it just sort of makes everyone better. The guys that rise up to it are the guys that earn playing time, and that makes the team better. And the guys that don't do as good a job and don't do the things they have to do, they sort of fall by the wayside and they see their minutes go down. And you will see transfers when situations like that happen. A lot of guys don't want to compete for minutes. A lot of guys don't want to change the way that they play or change their mentality. So, I mean, it's a possibility. I'm willing to give him a little more time. Like, he's a true freshman. It was kind of a rough season. He was thrust into a role he wasn't that familiar with. He was out of position a little bit. I'm willing to give him some time this year to see what he can do before, you know,
Dave
before,
Rice
casting,
ain't got that
before
time.
Casting him to the bench. And then, yeah, that's a good point. I mean, Dave Rice, he's basically got to make the NCAA tournament this year or he's gone. Is what everyone seems to think. So, I mean, exactly. He's not going to have a lot of time to show it, but I'm willing to give him, you know, practice preseason. They've got their closed door scrimmage against USC. They're going to have some intra squad things. I'm guessing they'll have preseason practice. They'll have time to evaluate how far along he's coming. They'll have a couple games at the beginning of the year. And if it's not working out, then, hey, Derek Jones gets his chance, or Ike Nwamu gets his chance at the four, or, you know, they move guys around and they give other guys a shot. So, you know, we just have to see how it plays out. But I agree with you. Like, it's doing what he did last year is he will not be a successful player at UNLV doing what he did last year.
One mid-range jump shot in the Maui Invitational and he's done.
You don't want to see him get into a shooting contest with Dantley Walker in the first round of the Maui Invitational.
That would actually be tremendous.
Just those two guys pulling up on every possession. Just
yes.
First one to miss loses.
And Chaminade wins by 16. Oh, that would be great. But anyway, he's Mike Grimala over at runrevs.com. I'm Tyler Bischoff here at Mountain West Connection. This has been the Towel Boys. Thanks for tuning in.